The title of this message is How to Follow Servant Leaders Like Nehemiah, Paul, and John. So we want to describe in this message three situations. One, following a heroic leader, Nehemiah. Problems with partisanship and the churches that Paul had to correct. And the problems of apostasy that were faced by the Apostle John. So let's go to Nehemiah. He's one of those biblical heroes that with Esther and Ruth and Ezra, you don't hear a lot about. But it's really a great story if you get to read it in a really good translation. It's even better than the King James. But he was a wine steward, got the emperor to appoint him governor to restore Jerusalem and the temple because they were fallen and ruined, and really things hadn't gone the way they should have for those that returned from captivity. So he comes down there and he looks at things secretly. Then he gets busy working on things. Chapter 2, verse 17. He encourages the people at this point to build the wall. And then said I, this is Nehemiah in the first person, unto them, you see the distress that we're in, how Jerusalem is waste, the gates thereof are burned with fire, and a city that didn't have walls and gates was vulnerable to vandals, thieves, marauders, etc. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we may be no more a reproach. Because it made them like a laughingstock. Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's words that he had spoken. Because the king had given him letters that gave him materials and authority to get material. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. So they were strengthened and encouraged to do the good work. But someone tried to discourage the people. We'll pick it up in verse 19. When Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the servant, the Ammonites, and Geshem the Arabian heard of it. By the way, they claim that the Ammonites are their descendants are the Palestinians. In case you see a parallel to what's going on today, at least a little bit of a parallel. I realize that maybe Israel is much stronger militarily, so there's a difference in that regard, but heard it. They laughed us to scorn, despised us, and said, what is this thing you plan on doing? Will you rebel against the king or emperor? And you're going to ask, why did they really care? Because they were, you know, a few miles away. Well, they think that the leader, Sanballat, and his cohorts wanted to extend their jurisdiction to Jerusalem and the Jewish areas. And they said, hey, you know, they're all going to be under the emperor, but they still wanted to have authority over all that. And probably it was root anti-Semitism, which, by the way, you know is growing in the world. If you watch the news, it's the real base anti-Semitism. As the world ramps up to evil, anti-Semitism always ramps up. Those two go in parallel the 1930s, I'm going through some new material on the 1930s and the rise of Hitler and the rise of anti-Semitism, and the parallels are stark. You just can't deny that as evil grows, anti-Semitism comes along with it. Then answered I them. Of course, you know it's the devil, obviously. He knows the nation that has God signs and are God's people, and the nation that brought forth Jesus Christ, the tribe of Judah. And the devil hates him with a purple passion. And as his influence grows, so does anti-Semitism. Then answered I them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we are his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion, nor rights, nor memorial in Jerusalem. In other words, he's saying, you've got no part of it. Get lost. He didn't play games with them. He was very strong and very courageous. You have no parts in the whole thing. They actually had allies among the Jewish people, and they were trying to work on him and soften him up and discourage him from getting the work done. And a good leader like Nehemiah helps focus the people that God is with us and we will succeed. Because that's really his message to the people of Judah. God is with us and we will succeed. You might hold your place in Nehemiah. I want to go back to 2 Kings 6:16. I want to show you a famous scripture. There was actually a famous movie called Chariots of Fire built on this scripture. This is the prophet Elijah, and one of his servants, an army has surrounded them, and the servant is really scared as to what's going to happen to them. So Elijah, we'll read it, 2 Kings 6:16. Elijah says to his servant, and he answered and said, "Fear not," just like Nehemiah said, "fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them." And Elijah prayed and said, "Lord," or the eternal God or Jehovah, "I pray you, open his eyes that he may see." The Lord opened his eyes, and the young man, and he saw, behold, the mountain was full of horses, chariots of fire round about Elijah. In other words, there are angels. I think the reason they say fire is because when angels are seen, they glow like fire. They probably Hollywood would have special effects for it now, but they're not visible to the human eye unless they want to be seen. I'm not even sure how that works, but it's sort of like Star Trek, out of phase, in phase, if you've seen some of those Star Trek ones, where our eyes can only see certain things. By the way, there are some animals who can see heat. They can hunt at night. We can't see it. They actually can see heat, infrared, and some other things. But our eyes can only see certain ranges, certain things. We can't see the spirit world. But Elijah the prophet could when he needed to, and he knew that they had an army protecting them. They didn't have to worry about a thing, an angelic army. Well, Nehemiah knew that God was with him. By the way, I want to just say something about the spirit world. We talked about this a little bit on the pod last night, but if you look at quantum physics, they used to think the atom was the smallest thing, because the atom is mostly empty space. No, it isn't. It's really squirrely after that, dark matter and all kinds of little... Notice the things that we thought were solid aren't solid. They're like energy in some form that's slowed down, and it's probably so complicated we don't fully yet understand it. The point I'm making is we are like energy that's been slowed down and put in a certain form. That's why the atomic bomb is so powerful. You know, a couple hundred pounds of uranium, when you release that energy, you can blow up a whole city. Of course, they got bigger bombs now. But the point is, but behind that energy is God and the spirit world. In other words, we're temporary. We're going to run down. Some of us are going to run down soon as we start to feel the aches and pains. We're temporary, but the spirit world is permanent. In other words, the world that we can't see is more real than our world. In other words, the spirit world that's God and is with us is more real and more powerful than the world that we're in. That's the point I want to make. Okay, back to Nehemiah. Nehemiah 4, verse 7. This is more opposition. They were plotting and scheming against them all the time. Nehemiah 4, 7. But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up, the breaches began to be stopped, they're angry. All they had to do, they pretty much got all the walls fixed at the right height. They had to put up the gates and a few minor things. They were mad. They conspired, all of them together, to come and fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. Nevertheless, we made our prayer unto God and set our watch day and night because of them. In other words, they realized that they were planning on some sneak attacks to kind of break up the work. As a good leader, he prepared the people for that. We'll go to verse 17. They which build it on the wall, and they that bear burdens, carrying bricks and mortar and lumber, with those that laden every one with his hands wrought in the work, and with his other hand held a weapon. In other words, they were carrying the thing for the brick mortar and the bricks, but they also had swords with them. He also positioned behind them certain groups of soldiers at certain spaces with trumpets. So just think of that. They're building and they're guarding at the same time. For the builders, verse 18, everyone had his sword girded by his side, and so build it, and they sounded the trumpet, was with me. In other words, he had a trumpeter with him, which is what that's military communications in those days. Because the wall of Jerusalem is such a big city. Well, if they attack us in a weak spot, blow the trumpet, and all our troops will gather at that point and combat them. And he said to the nobles, to the rulers, to the rest of the people, the work is great and large, and we are separated upon the wall, one far from another. So in what place, therefore, you hear the sound of the trumpet, you know, everybody come to that point to do battle, to save the day. And so that's what they did. And, of course, by the way, their enemy went to delay tactics to try to unnerve them. I think for a minute about what Iran is doing. Obviously, this is my opinion. You know that they want to build an A-bomb because they want to blow up Israel. You all know that. And you know that those imams, their philosophy is they don't mind dying. So, you know, you say, well, if they blow up Israel, Israel will attack them back. They don't care. I mean, that's their religious philosophy. Crazy or not, that's it. Now, do you think when they are talking with America and others to get money, and they've gotten a bunch of it as part of the, we're going to talk about delaying it. So far, it's been talk, and they were supposed to last week come up with a plan to slow down or delay. They haven't actually done anything but just talk. While they're still collecting enough uranium to build a bomb. It's a delay tactic, and in my opinion, and it's working. They've gotten a certain amount of billions of dollars back, and they really haven't done anything to slow down the bomb building, or very little slowing down. Well, they had a delay tactic as well, and they wanted Nehemiah to stop the work and come down to one of their towns and talk about it and discuss it with them, and he wasn't buying it. And then they tried various conspiracies to frighten him. And they did have some allies among some of the Jews. He wouldn't buy it. And this is one of the verses I think that's more of a great verse for Nehemiah. If you go to Nehemiah 6, verse 10. Afterwards, I came unto the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabeel, who was shut up, as he was kind of protecting himself. And he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us shut the door of the temple, you know, in that inner room where we'll be safe. For they will come to slay you. They've got a plot. And they've got some really good assassins coming to get you. In the middle of the night, they're going to come and slay you. Notice what Nehemiah's response was, 6:11. He said, should a man such as I flee? You know, should a man such as myself hide out like a coward? And it's believed that part of the plot was also, the moment he hid out, they would tell the people, well, they've got Nehemiah afraid. We better stop the work. He's hiding out. You don't see him out here leading and doing anything. They're going to get us. He didn't. By the way, their neighbors never did attack them. They threatened, but because they were prepared, they never did attack. Now, they tried delay tactics. They tried frightening tactics, conspiracy tactics, but it didn't work. As he says, a man such as I should run and hide. He was brave, and he set an example of courage. And I thought of something. You know, one of the things mentioned in Revelation 21 is God does not want people who are cowards. God expects us to show a certain amount of faith in God and courage. That's my stupid cell phone. I don't know what it's telling me. But anyway, to show a certain amount of courage. Because it's kind of surprising when you see it there. It's listed among a lot of bad things. God wants courage. He wants us to show some courage and to be brave about the work that God wants us to do. And, you know, courage takes... There obviously has to be some risk, or, you know, people say, well, if I'm not courageous, they might persecute me, and friends and relatives will criticize me, and I could lose jobs. By the way, I'm not saying any of that isn't true, but that's why you have to be courageous. Here's a joke about courage, A man and his wife walk into a dentist's office. The man said to the dentist, "Doc, I'm in a terrible hurry. I have two buddies sitting out in my car waiting for us to go play golf. Forget about the anesthetic. I don't have time for gums to get numb. I just want you to pull the tooth and be done with it. We have a 10 a.m. tee time. We just barely got it. And the best golf course, the best people in the world. This is a great opportunity. And it's almost 9:30 already. So I don't have time to wait for anesthetic to work." The dentist thought to himself, "My, wow, are you a brave man asking to have his tooth pulled without using anything to kill the pain? Are you brave?" The man turned to his wife and said, "Open your mouth, honey, and show him which tooth." That's bravery. This is T-shirt humor requested by my granddaughter. I'll throw it in here. The T-shirt says, "An apple a day keeps everyone away if you learn how to throw it hard enough." If you want to be tough. Well, let's go to the second example. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 3. This is the Apostle Paul in the Corinthian church. 1 Corinthians 3. And in this, the Corinthian church prior to this, you know, one said, "I'm of Paul, I'm of Peter, I'm of Apollos, I'll do all that, I'm of Christ." And they were divided and petty and immature. And so Paul is working with this petty, immature church. But he gives some leadership principles that I want to mention this afternoon. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 21. "Therefore, let no man glory in men, for all things are yours." In other words, he's saying, don't put church leaders on a pedestal. Don't put church leaders on a pedestal. That's what it means by glory in men. It's sort of like my team, your team. I Apollos, he's my guy. Here's what I think from what I've read. I think this is true of Apollos. Obviously, we can't know for certain, but probably it's true. Apollos was Greek like most of them. He was probably tall, handsome, and he was an expert in Greek rhetoric. And Greek rhetoric, there's a certain style, stylistically. He probably used his words stylistically, beautifully. And I'm not saying anything wrong with that. And Paul... Now, there's no way Paul was not an effective speaker. He turned the world upside down. But Paul was not, in the Greek rhetorical style, stylistic. Paul was straightforward, blunt, and obviously powerful, but not in a style that the Greeks would admire stylistically. And I'm just saying this from what we've read, maybe he was short and bald and not so good looking. There's nothing wrong with being bald, though. But, and so Apollos cut a much greater figure. And I can see people saying, "Oh, there he is. Oh, Apollos, he's our man." And Peter probably had a certain swagger and energy. And, there's something to be said for Peter. But obviously, Paul was the one to start the church. Some people like Paul. But can you see they were glorying in men? Can you see they were glorying in men and not glorying in God in the right way? It was kind of a sign of spiritual immaturity. Verse 22, Paul says, "Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all are yours. And you are Christ and Christ is God's." In other words, those men were there just to serve the church. In other words, Paul was there to serve the church. Peter was there to serve the church. Paul was there to serve the church. As he says in another part of 1 Corinthians, Paul laid the foundation when he got it started and was the master builder. Apollos watered and kept it growing, and Peter added in. But don't put people on a pedestal. Then if they have any trouble, your faith isn't shaken. Because, people are people. Don't put them on a pedestal. I think what Paul is doing in this section of the book, He's saying don't put leaders up too high, but also don't put certain ones down too low. We'll see that as we get into chapter 4. They're all servants, and that's why I call it servant leadership. 1 Corinthians 4:1. Let a man so account of us, Paul's referring to the leaders like himself, as of ministers. By the way, minister really means servant. I know we've turned into the minister of defense and the minister of agriculture and other things. It has a big title, but originally it meant servant. The ministers of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Let me explain what a steward was, because we don't really see it in today's world. A steward was, we might call him a high-ranking slave in their world. Let's say if you had a big housing complex and you were some big wig in the Roman Empire, or it could be other empires. And this went on, well, really, through most of human history. This is true. You might take your sharpest, most loyal, your best slave and servant and say, I'm going to put you in charge of all the other slaves and the running of the household. That would leave you and maybe your wife free to socialize and do more out stuff. You didn't have to worry about cooking food and buying food and shopping for this and shopping for that and a whole bunch of other things that people had to worry about. And as far as that leader was concerned, the other slaves, he was like their master because he was in charge. You put him in charge and he was the head guy. I could actually give you some nicknames for those kind of things, but I'll stay out of trouble. But he was the head guy. He kind of ran things. But to the big time owner, he was a slave. And of course, the analogy is that Paul is the steward of the church, but he's the slave of Jesus Christ, the true owner of the church. That's the analogy that Paul is giving. Moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. Let's say if you pick someone to be steward of your giant complex, and maybe you have 40 servants and a family, and, you know, by the way, some of the stewards could also be in charge of your kids. They had tutors, and they have other titles besides tutors, but they had various titles, and they could spank the kids if they were wrong, and they'd educate the kids and teach them all kinds of stuff. And then when the kid became 18 or 20, whatever the age majority was, the kid switched positions. He was now the heir to the whole business, and, you know, he became one of the... But that's how responsible they wanted the top stewards to be. And obviously, if your steward is stealing from the household or abusing the other slaves or all kinds of bad things he could be doing that messing up, you know, that's a bad thing. You want to stop that. And using that analogy of the steward, you know, Paul is saying, I've been a good steward and faithful. And by the way, when you go through this letter and the next one, Paul elaborates more on how faithful he was and all the things he did, all the things he went through, which we don't have time to go through. But believe me, when you read the first two books, letters to the Corinthians, you see how faithful Paul was as a steward, as he says, more than all the other apostles, and history backs that up. But with me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged of you or of man's judgment. Yea, I judge not my own self. Now, you're going to say, what is that all about? I think encouraged by some false prophets and false teachers, and they did it because they wanted to take the church in the wrong direction, I think, and gain more power and money for themselves. And maybe they just were just misguided. It could be a whole bunch of reasons. They were trying to turn Paul into the Rodney Dangerfield of the Corinthian church. Remember Rodney Dangerfield? I can't get any respect. Well, that's the position they're trying to put Paul in. Nobody respected him. And in part, you know, Paul didn't take any money from the Corinthian church, even though he was there over a year and a half, built that church to be one of the biggest. He worked with his own hands to support himself. And you're going to say, I mean, logically, you'd say, they should appreciate it. But there's something weird about human nature. The more you do for people, the less they appreciate it. I can't even explain it, but I've seen it in operation with all kinds of people, in all kinds of situations. So it's just the way things are. I mean, at least for a while. And I'm I think some people in the Corinthian church were like spoiled brats, spiritually speaking. He did a lot for, oh, I don't want this, I don't want that. He's not good enough. Well, he's not as cool as Apollos. And, you know, as I say, in a rhetorical, styly sense, he probably wasn't. And looks either. Based on everything in both books, he probably wasn't in looks either. And by the way, I know people judge on looks a lot, and they really shouldn't do that. They've already proven that tall, handsome men get more leadership brownie points. And I saw that in the army, too. It's not the way things should be, but that's how human nature is. What can I tell you? It's not right, but it's the way things are. going on to verse 4. By the way, but Paul was telling them that their evaluation of him didn't matter. It's only how what Christ felt. Verse 4. For I know nothing by myself, yet I'm not hereby justified, but he that judges me is the Lord. What he's saying there, he's not saying he's perfect. He's just saying I'm not aware of any time that I wasn't a faithful servant. There's no great boiling problem that Paul knows of. But he says the truth is, I don't even judge myself. Christ will do that final judgment of how good a job I've done. Now, some people might say, hey, I'll do a verse 4, 1 Corinthians 4, 4, 3 and 4, and I'll tell people, I don't care what you think of me. I can be as abrasive and ugly and uncooperative with the church and the church leaders. I can do anything I want because I'm like Paul. I'm only being judged by God. Let me ask you. If the Corinthian church had written back to Paul and said, hey, Paul, we don't care what you think of us. It's only Christ's judgment. We're going to do anything we want. What do you think Paul would have said? When I get there, we shall see. By the way, you go through the two Corinthians, Paul leaves a threat to the troublemakers. He says, shall I come to you in love and peace, or shall I come with a whip? I mean, when you get a good translation, that's what it really means. Paul had power. He said, you're going to see my power. I don't exactly know how he would use his power. And I believe when he did get there, and he did get there, he did use his power. And some of those people probably regretted messing with Paul because that church lasted for a long time. He also sent Timothy there to take over and kind of straighten them out. And that church lasted for many centuries with the truth. So Paul did get it straightened out. And Paul would say, oh, yeah? You don't think I have any power? And let's talk about what Paul said. We can't say that because we're not in Paul's position. Paul was a first century apostle, an apostle who had his commission directly from Christ. It's sort of like in the old days when the king of England gave a commission to some officer and said, I want you to take a fleet to go down to Magellan and take over, whatever. Well, that's a direct commission from the royalty. That's how the term originally got. Well, Paul had a direct commission from Christ. That's power. Nobody on earth today can claim that kind of power. And I mean, let's face it. You're not going to go, well, I don't have to cooperate with the church or anybody else finding leadership. It's just me and you, Christ. Well, you haven't been commissioned like Paul. You can't say the same kind of things Paul said. And we can't be like Paul. That's just the truth. And Paul would not tolerate it. You read the rest of the Corinthians. He let them know that when I get there, you know, they say, oh, your letters are beautiful. But in person, you don't look that good and you're kind of weak. Meaning he was nice and pleasant. He says, you're going to see how strong I can be if I have to be. He left them clear threat. And I think they got straightened out to some extent with Timothy before Paul got there. But he may have had to deal with some troublemakers in that church. But Paul did have power because that church lasted. Let's see, I think I read verse 5 already. Let me read verse 5. Therefore, judge nothing before the time. In other words, don't evaluate Paul's work or anything else. Judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who both will bring to light the hidden things of darkness, because there are a lot of hidden plots and bad stuff that certain people have done that you don't know about. Not that you need to worry about it. He's just saying it'll come to light if necessary. I mean, some things will be just between God and the sinner if he repents, but hidden things of darkness, and will make manifest the counsel of the hearts, and then shall every man have praise of God. In other words, people can't really evaluate each other that accurately because we can't read the hearts of people. Have you noticed if you ask somebody to evaluate themselves in a really deep discussion, they're either too hard on themselves or they're too easy on themselves. You ever notice that? Either too hard on themselves or too easy. It is rare you talk to somebody about their own life and what they have or haven't done that you get a really good balanced picture. Some people, I can get away with anything, you know, or it's got to be my way. Else, others are much too hard on themselves. And even in evaluating others, I think human nature is just hard to be objective. And it is. So he was just saying, leave that up to God and don't worry about it. Verse 7, For who makes you to differ from one another? In other words, if you've got more gifts than somebody else, it's God that did it. And what have you that you did not receive? Now, if you did receive it, why do you glory as if you had not received it? One of the problems the Corinthian church had is some people in that church had gifts, you know, the gifts of foreign languages. Apparently, there was a bunch of gifts that were given to all the churches in those days, even the church members that weren't that mature. I mean, that's pretty clear when you read the book of Corinth. And Paul is saying, okay, you're getting all puffed up, or certain people in the group were, because you've got the gift of prophecy or the gift of tongues or the gift of certain miracles or the gift of healings. It doesn't make you such a great guy because you got the gift. God gave it to you. You could even say that in the regular world. Let's say if someone's a great musician, great athlete, great engineer, you realize I'm not taking everything away from your own efforts. But you inherited certain potential gifts. It's like Mozart was a musical genius at 6. Now, you know he didn't get that from practicing. There are tons of people, there's even a story, tons of people who practiced for years who wanted to be musical geniuses, but they just didn't have the gift. At best, they were only mediocre. And they envied Mozart. Mozart admitted, he says, I'm a crappy man as a person, but my music is fabulous. He was gifted. Some people are just born. You hear them play a piano at 10 years old, and you know they're gifted. You know, it's a gift. And some people have the gift of charm, and I guess there's so many different human nature gifts that people can get. And he's saying, don't get puffed up because of your gifts. You got it because God gave it to you. And he's telling the people they need to cooperate. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 10:33. First Corinthians 10, verse 33, Paul says, even as I please all men in all things. So Paul was not, even though he said they had no right to judge him, he wasn't mistreating the people or not trying to be nice. Even though I try to please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit. In other words, Paul was a servant leader. Everything he did for the Corinthian people. He could have asked for money, which he later said in the second book he could have. He had the right, but he didn't. He was serving them, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. Now, that's a really servant leader attitude. Notice the next verse, 11:1. Be you followers of me, even as I am of Christ. So he's telling them they need to follow the founder of that church, who is Paul, but only as, of course, he follows Christ in a biblical way. So the advice Paul would give us now is that we should follow leadership as long as it stays biblical and with Christ. And as I said before, Paul was an original apostle, so you could trust him. But I want to add this much. When I say follow leadership as long as they're biblical and doing the right thing, don't be a perfectionist. Say, well, if I can find even the tiniest little thing that I disagree with you over, that's my excuse to leave the church and start my own church. You know, that's a recipe for churches the size of 2. And then if they eventually have a minor, then churches the size of 1. Now think about it. You could get, or you could argue about, this has happened to people. What's the best translation, NIV or the King James? Well, it depends on the verse. You can, you know, I like that translation better. You like the other one better. Hey, that's a difference of opinion. You're wrong. I'm right. I'm leaving. You can see how petty. Well, maybe I've actually seen church people fight over things almost that petty. And one guy's, I'm leaving. Start my own group. And out he goes. Or goes to some other group, and then they fight, and then they go down and down and down and down and down. It's a sad tale. Now let's go to the third one, the prophet, the apostle John. This is 3 John 3. 3 John 3. And in 3 John 3, the situation has changed. Let me read 3 John 3, then I'll tell you what the church has thought for years. It's called the lost century. 3 John 3, verse 9 through 11. This is John writing some church people in some area and says, I wrote unto the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, loves, he's Mr. Big, receives us not, as he won't receive the apostle John, one of the big three that was closest to Christ and took care of Christ's mother Mary. He won't receive him. Wherefore, if I come, I'll remember his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. In other words, he was undermining Paul, John's reputation, and those who supported John. And some people are good at chopping down others' reputation. Chop, chop, chop. Even if some of what they say is true, it still may be done for malicious purposes. Not content therewith, neither does he himself receive the brethren and forbids them that would cast them out of the church. In other words, if you come from a church that's associated with the Apostle John, and you talk to those people, I'm kicking you out. So he's isolating those people to his leadership only. Beloved, follow not that which is evil. That's what he's calling Diotrephes. But that which is good. He that doeth good is of God. He that doeth evil has not seen God. Now the church talked about for years the lost century. The first century, covering the book of Acts, through about AD 95, the last book was written, the book of Revelation. Then what we think, the next century, there's no records there. None. Nothing. And so when you come into the third century, the church that's most public, most visible, is significantly different than the true church that existed in the first century. By the way, it's possible that John never got to those, to Gaius and others, because at least we think shortly after this, he was put under arrest and sent to the Isle of Patmos. It's kind of an island exile. In other words, John died a natural death as the last, as far as you know, of the apostles, an old man, probably close to 100 years old. But he did get exiled by political powers because they didn't like what he was preaching. So he maybe, and he wrote the book of Revelation from the Isle of Patmos, he maybe never got back, or at least not in any timely fashion. So what we think happened during the lost century is people like Diotrephes, and this is 90 AD, almost the end of the century, false leaders snuck in there, and that second generation Christians were a little easier to deceive than the original generation of Christians, like the 40 years we talked about last week. And many of them fell into churches that were being influenced by Satan the devil. And by the time the end of the lost century is over, the majority of the church, especially in the West, that is most of Western Europe and Rome, some of those around Corinth stayed loyal into the third century when they actually had to send Roman soldiers there to, quote, stop those churches from doing things which they considered to be Judaizing. And the bishops in Rome who had power could do that. In other words, eventually that church got joined with the Roman Empire, and Constantine converted to Christianity and as the emperor of the Roman Empire, and that church, which we consider an apostate church, became the official church of the Holy Roman Empire and now had the power of Rome, because the Pope and the Emperor worked together. And so, Constantine said to these churches, you better stop doing this and this and this and the other thing. you realize that they could send legions after those people and make you do it or else. So we believe the true church was driven underground and reduced to a very, very small size. And that makes sense. And then, of course, the Catholic Church was the dominant church. When the Roman Empire fell, it became even more dominant during the Dark Ages when the empire was weak and the church, relatively speaking, in the Dark Ages was strong. And the rest, I guess, is history. So, but what do we get out of that? What do we learn from that lesson? We learn that once the church fell, there are no more apostles, but the church did have major leaders like Peter Waldo, Herbert Armstrong, Garner Ted Armstrong, and others came along from here there to pick up the small, scattered church and keep it alive. It means that we have to look for who the true leaders are. And really what John is saying in verse 12, he's telling the people get his letter who aren't afraid to read it. Some were probably afraid to read it because the Archbishop finds out I read the letter from John, they'll kick me out of the church. And we actually lived to see that in the worldwide church before it imploded. Demetrius has a good report of all men, and of the truth itself, yea, and we also bear record. And you know that our record is true. So he's telling them, organize around Demetrius. He's still with us. He's still with the truth. So you have to look for the truth in a world that has been apostatized and follow that true leadership.